Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, we're talking with Thomas Grace about his book, Kent State, Death and Dissent in the Long 60s. Tom, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
I'm a native of Syracuse, New York. I was born in 1950, the oldest of four children. Both of my parents are college educated, although they both came from working class backgrounds. My father's probably more impoverished than my mother's. They both experienced the Depression growing up. That had quite an impact on their political loyalties, particularly my father's. He was an ardent New Dealer. And as the oldest of four children, I seem to have inherited many of his beliefs, which he almost taught by rote learning. So I was very much my father's son. When it came time for me to consider colleges, I became familiar with Kent State because my father had hired a man who had recently graduated from Kent State. My father at that time was a social work administrator working for the state of New York, and he had gone to Kent State. So that put the school on my radar, and it was one of four colleges or universities that I had applied to. And of the public universities, I was accepted at all of the schools that I applied. And of the public universities, it was the closest to our Syracuse, New York home, even though it was still a good 6 hours distance on the New York State Thruway and Interstate 90. What further attracted me to Kent was the school's history department and its rich offerings of courses in American history, which became one of my two majors while I was a student there, the other being political science.
So, because that's one of the, and I think that your biography is very important in terms of this book, because while what you're writing is not a memoir per se, one of the things that I was struck by as I was reading it was how there's such a rich familiarity with Kent State during this period in your book. And I think it's one of the things that really distinguishes it in terms of what your approach is. Was this a book that you had been planning to write for a long period of time, or is this a book that you decided to write more recently?
Well, without getting too deep into the weeds, it was a book actually that I never intended to write. It came about largely by chance. I met the man who became the editor of the book at the Organization of American Historians annual meeting in 1990, I believe. And it was a chance meeting. I stopped at the press table book to buy the biography of John Brown that was written by Stephen Oates, I believe, to purge this land with blood. Brown lived in Kent for a time when the community was called Franklin Mills, Ohio. And Clark, in the course of about a 45-minute discussion, I had not discovered, because I decided to share it with him eventually, that I had been among the students who was wounded at Kent State. And Clark was a Cleveland native who had gone to Kenyon. And he's an acquisitions editor, so of course he's at the conference trying to find people with existing manuscripts or ones that might be of interest to the reading public and to academic audiences. So he pitched the idea actually there. I had just graduated from the University of Buffalo at the time with an MA with no intention of going on to obtain a PhD. And it took another 5 years before I decided to, and by that time I had re-enrolled at the University of Buffalo in the doctoral program. And after about 5 years, I decided that I would switch my focus and indeed my centuries, because I had previously been studying the American Civil War. That's been a lifelong passion of mine, and do a study of Kent State. And that's how it came about.
Wow. So you've been working on this book for a long period of time.
Yes, the dissertation covered, I did the work, the research and writing of that between 1999 and 2003. That only covered the years between 1958 and 1964. And I retired from an earlier career in 2005, began some adjunct teaching, and expanded and revised the initial dissertation to take the story up through January of 1973, which is when the Paris Peace Accords were signed. So the book winds up covering a period, a fairly long period of historical time from 1958 to January of 1973. And I would say all in all, I probably spent about 10 years on the writing and research. It takes a long time, of course. Those who've written and had published academic press books know that it takes a long time to get them through to publication. My manuscript was actually turned in, I believe, in 2010, and it wasn't published until early 2016. So it was the better part of 5 or 6 years from the time that it was submitted till it was published.
I was wondering if you could explain to us why you went all the way back to the late 1950s. How does that inform our understanding of what happened at Kent State in 1970?
Well, first of all, I had an outsider's perspective on Kent, Ohio. Arriving there in fall of 1968, there were a growing number of out-of-state students, but still in all, the majority of my classmates were native Ohioans. And I noticed a number of things about Ohio that was somewhat different from my own community. First of all, Kent and Portage County, the county in which Kent is located in, was still fairly small and largely rural in 1968. But the students came to know at Kent State, they often came from large industrial cities such as Cleveland or Akron or the city of Barberton, where my roommate was from. His name was Alan Canfora, and his photo was actually on the cover of the book. Others were from Canton and Massillon and Youngstown, places like that. So they were largely the sons and, in some cases, the daughters of working class people, and often, in fact, usually the first in their families to go to college. So we went to school in a small, rural, and fairly conservative town, but the students that were drawn to Kent State tended to come from these industrial cities. Or increasingly from out of state locales such as myself, and we were able to travel back and forth to Kent State because of the development of the interstate highway systems, which greatly reduced the amount of travel time that someone would have to spend going back and forth to school for school breaks and in the summertime and all. So I began to think about how that tension, that small town, big city tension that was present in Kent may have informed the mentality of the students that went to school there. And as I learned, many of these kids came from unionized families. And as I got more involved in the political life of the campus, I began to realize that some of the kids came from old left families. By that I mean their parents had been members of the Communist Party, or they may have been in a socialist club. If their parents went to college, they may have been in a socialist club when they when their parents were growing up. And there were a variety of these influences that helped shape the outlook of the students. And that showed to me at any rate, that there was a certain amount of political continuity between what many historians and political scientists refer to as the New Deal era or the New Deal order and the 1960s student protesters. And this type of outlook is shared by some historians, but generally people who study the era tend to focus on the generation gap and the tension between young people and their parents. And while that was undeniable, particularly in the cultural realm, in the political realm at Kent State, that was far less apparent. And indeed, one can see that there was a fair amount of continuity in the shared belief systems between the generation era parents and the baby boom and their baby boom offspring.
That idea of continuity also plays out in another aspect of your book in the early chapters, which is the continuity between the protest, the activism that you describe in the late 60s up to 1970, and then this period of activism that predated you, but was tied to the civil rights movement. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the culture of activism in Kent State prior to the Vietnam War, and how that contributed to the culture that you experienced when you arrived there.
Okay. Well, yes, I can do that. First of all, just maybe a quick word on the town of Kent, because that impacted the growth of the movement in its own perhaps paradoxical way. The town of Kent, which had been called Franklin Mills up until the time of the Civil War, and then it was renamed Kent in honor of a man who brought the railroad to Franklin Mills in 1863. His name was Marvin Kent. Was a fairly conservative place that really didn't change its character all that much until probably around the turn of the last century, the 19th to the 20th century. And in 1910, the town landed the college, which was then a normal school. But the town itself was beginning to change as well because of an influx, not a large one, but an influx of southern migrants, most of whom were African American, and the immigration influx of Italian Americans into the town. And that, of course, was all occurring at the time of the last century. But 50 years later, that really hadn't changed Kent all that much, because I remember when I was looking at an interview that was done with a man by the name of John Carson, he described the town of Kent in 1960 as being, I think he called it a segmented community. In other words, these groups still lived apart from one another. And while that doesn't make Kent unique, it did indicate that, from my point of view, that the town itself was fairly inhospitable to African Americans. And one other thing I probably should add here, that the university's Greek fraternities and sororities also reflected this as well, because they had racial covenants that prevented them from having African American members. So even before there was some labor protest or students supporting unions that were fighting a right to work amendment in 1958 and dealing actively with the city's segregated patterns, there was already a group that had styled themselves the Macedonians. And Carl Oglesby, who some listeners and readers will know as, I think, the third or fourth president of the Students for a Democratic Society, which was a radical anti-war organization that formed on college campuses in 1960 and 61, first at the University of Michigan. Harold Oglesby was a student at Kent State, and he was part of this group called the Macedonians. And they had styled themselves that because the Macedonians of old had opposed the Greeks in many wars. And from their point of view, the Macedonians now are going to take on the Greek fraternity and sorority system. And some of the students who, there were maybe 15 or 20 people in this friendship circle, and some of the students who were part of this friendship network came from old left families and actually read, had the Daily Worker delivered to them every day or slipped under their door. But the research that I did shows that it was Kent's segregated housing patterns and the discriminatory practices in terms of public accommodations that produced the first real protest in town and then later on the campus. Blacks who lived in Kent could not use the university pool, but that was open to white residents of Kent. Restaurants and bars did not often serve African Americans, while some of the machine shops in Kent did not employ blacks. And a friend of mine who I didn't interview for the book, but he told me about this later. When he grew up in Kent in the 1950s, he recalled that when he needed clothing, that his mother had to take him shopping to the more distant city of Akron because the stores in Kent would not allow blacks to try on clothing to determine if the articles fit properly.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, please. So you're talking about how there were these issues which we associate with the early 60s that definitely left an imprint upon the Kent State community, and how you see a small group of students, and you describe in the book sometimes how they would undertake these protests very hesitantly. This wasn't this wasn't, say, New York City. They were very well aware of this, about how it was this very, brave in some ways, effort that they're taking to try to affect change in a, in this very conservative town, which is really, in many ways, hasn't been fully transformed by this rapidly expanding university in their midst.
Exactly. It was an inhospitable environment. But what happened was that sympathetic whites, at least some sympathetic whites, saw what their African-American college classmates were experiencing. Protests began to ensue. So the town's Woolworth store was picketed in Kent after the Southern sit-ins of the same store swept much of the nation in 1960. And then in October of 1960, a dozen or so Kent students held a sit-in of their own. It was a place called the Corner Bar. It was now known as the Loft, that refused to serve blacks. And that was successful. It slowly led to change and acceptance of African Americans being served in Kent's establishments. And then a year later, and this was in 1961, some of the same students who were involved in these protests and the one sit-in were emboldened enough to challenge what they saw as the university's complicity with segregated off-campus housing practices. And the president of Kent State at the time, a man by the name of George Bowman, he dug his heels in the face of these protests, but he finally relented when sympathetic faculty weighed in on behalf of the students. And this part of the story is a bit murky in terms of what happened, but apparently the state NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, apparently threatened the university with a lawsuit. And all of this occurred, by the way, against the backdrop of Russian educators visiting the campus, which provided placed pressure on the university because they didn't want to be embarrassed by these racial practices at a time that professors from the Soviet Union were meeting with their counterparts at Kent State. Because after all, the United States was trying to present a face to the world that they were a beacon of freedom, while at the same time the Soviet Union was taking advantage of these discriminatory practices that were so widespread and indeed embedded in many places in the United States, and pointing to the hypocrisy of the United States, claiming that they were a beacon of freedom while these practices were so widespread in the country.
That's one of the things you do in your book that I think really helps to set everything in context, which is you don't just describe the activist groups and their causes, but you also describe there were conservative students as well who counter-protested, and how the faculty were oftentimes, and administration were oftentimes divided or in positions where they were having to mediate between these contesting groups and dealing with all these various interests. It really does seem to demonstrate how this very contentious or very fraught and sometimes in some respects for the administrators perilous environment existed even before the Vietnam War. The challenges of adapting to change, while at the same time acknowledging that not everyone is in favor of doing this.
Exactly, and I might add here that Kent's president, George Bowman, he remained in his position until 1963, and then the vice president of the university was named the heir apparent, his name was Robert White. And during the course, here's where writing a book about an experience that one had participated in gets a little tricky. At one time, I was a plaintiff in a civil lawsuit against the Ohio National Guard and President White, and I did not care for him at all as a result of his stewardship or lack thereof of Kent State University. But I must say that during the course of my research, I gained a newfound measure of sympathy for the position that he was in, because he definitely was guilty of a failure in leadership, I also felt that he was in a no-win position, because if he was seen as coddling student protesters, then he experienced an avalanche of criticism from the right. Whereas if he failed to act quickly to address matters of racial discrimination, he was soundly criticized on the political left and from the African American community. And all the while, he's trying to balance all this with by keeping the governor of the state from getting too involved in the university's internal affairs, like most. People who run an organization, they'd like to be left to run that on their own without having to deal with what they regard as a lot of intrusion.
And you describe how during this period, the state began to establish greater control over the universities with the establishment of the Board of Regents. So this is all happening
exactly
at a time when the state, and you're talking about, a very formidable figure, the former John Rhodes, who is coming in and not only is the state exerting more influence, but Rhodes is perfectly willing to use politics and to, maybe this is a little bit harsh, too harsh of a phrase, exploit the situation for his own political goals.
Exactly. And of course, that very exploitation was very much in evidence in May of 1970. But we can perhaps get to that a little later in the course of the discussion.
I was wondering if you could talk about now how the Vietnam War comes into play and how it changes the culture in the mid-1960s. Because as you've explained, the focus initially is more upon civil rights. It's more upon these other issues that are very domestically focused. There is an international element in terms of the Cold War, but it is not as large of an element as the Vietnam War becomes in terms of foreign policy considerations. When does that shift begin, and how deep and broad is it in 65, 66, 67?
Well, first of all, the 60s can often be best understood as a series of cascading movements. And this was true not only of Kent State, but I think it was true of many campuses throughout the country. Because while the early 1960s protests, as we've just discussed, focus on supporting Southern civil rights sit-ins and the integrating of local public accommodations in Kent. And there were even some Kent State students that had gone south. There was one who joined a group known as the Freedom Riders in 1961. And there were other students that went and participated in the Selma March or the 66 march that was known as the Meredith March or the March Against Fear in Mississippi. But by 64 and 65, of course, the war is beginning to heat up. At Kent State in the spring of 1964, one of the first protests in Ohio occurred. It was a very small picket, really. It was more of a picket than a protest, but it still in all marked one of the first protests against the Vietnam War in the state. And then by February of 1965, in response to an attack on an American base in South Vietnam, President Lyndon Johnson, who had become president after the assassination of John F. Kennedy in November of 1963. In 1965, Johnson, who had been newly reelected, decides to punish North Vietnam for having launched this assault on this American base and unleashes a series of bombings on North Vietnam that continued almost unabated for the next 3 years or so up until 1968. And that produced another small protest at Kent State. You earlier remarked on what some would consider the bravery or courage of the students at Kent State who were protesters. Well, these six or seven students required all of that because they were confronted by 200 angry counter-protesters. And that would have been enough to discourage most people, but it didn't discourage any of them. They were all members of a group called the Young Socialist Alliance, which, not to get too deep into the weeds here, but they was a student arm of another group called the Socialist Workers Party that were Trotskyists in their orientation, so-called because of their belief in the theories of the former Bolshevik Leon Trotsky. So they were not the kind of people to be easily discouraged, even when they were being threatened and having things thrown at them. And indeed, one young woman whose photograph is in the book was actually kicked in the head during the demonstration. And I remember interviewing her about that many years later. She just kind of brushed it off and had the attitude that they weren't going to allow something like that to discourage them. And indeed, they did not. I'd like to say too that the working class and democratic character of many of the students at Kent State in some ways helped to further the growth of protest there. But when it came to the Vietnam War, initially I think it inhibited it, because if most of the students from these urban industrialized areas are Democrats, and their families and their parents would have supported Lyndon Johnson for the presidency, and Johnson was supportive and indeed had signed into law many very progressive and indeed path-breaking laws or pieces of legislation such as the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, Medicare and Medicaid, and later open housing in 1968. They were very hesitant to break with President Johnson over the war. So many of them initially supported these counter protests. And it was students that came from these old left families, or maybe their father had been a Henry Wallace progressive, or maybe their uncle had fought in Spain and had been involved in the Socialist Party. These were the kind of young people that were active in the anti-war movement at the beginning. So the anti-war movement grew steadily at Kent State, but also very slowly because of this complicated political environment that that was the case at Kent State.
You connect the evolution of the protest to that election of 1964 because, as you describe, a lot of these students were very passionate in their support for Johnson or their opposition to Barry Goldwater, who was seen as this warmonger. And it seems that the mental shift necessary to go from viewing Johnson as the sane, more pacific choice to Johnson as the kid killer, if you will, going back to the slogan, it takes them a while to do this. And in part, it's because in 1965, Vietnam doesn't seem like it's necessarily going to become what it is by 1968, of course.
Right. And one of the things that began to, I think there were two things in particular that began to cause students at Kent State to shift their thinking. One was the cost of the war itself. Because these kids are coming from working class backgrounds, and of course there's a well-known book that some listeners and readers will recognize and perhaps have read, called Working Class War by Christian Oppie. We know that the war was largely fought by people from the working class. And it wasn't that uncommon for students to have an older brother, that was fighting in the war, or a neighbor or a cousin. Nor was it, unfortunately, all that unusual for someone to be killed over there who was a brother or a cousin or a friend or a neighbor. And that, of course, really brought home the cost of the war. The other thing was that by 1968, with the presidential election that featured three candidates, Lyndon Johnson, then he dropped out, and Hubert Humphrey and Bobby Kennedy and Gene McCarthy were all vying for the Democratic nomination. Richard Nixon had a fairly clear path to the Republican nomination. But then the political scene was also complicated by the entry of George Wallace, the former governor of Alabama, as an independent candidate for the presidency. So all of this, I don't want to get too deeply into this because a lot of readers, of course, are going to know what transpired in that year. But some readers may, and listeners may have forgotten that in August of 1968, when the Democrats were determining who their presidential aspirant was going to be, that being Vice President Hubert Humphrey, there were a series of very confrontational protests in Chicago. And on nationwide television, hundreds and hundreds of students were beaten by Chicago police. I think there was the Kerner Report that later deemed it a police riot. And that was seen by millions and millions of young people and tens of millions of older Americans, who drew sharply different conclusions from what they were watching on television. The students saw it as unnecessary and brutal repression, whereas older people saw it as like mindless violence that indicated that the country was desperately in need of someone to bring some order out of all of this chaos.
And as you describe, among the students protesting in Chicago in August 1968, there were more than just a few from Kent State itself.
Yes. There were groups of students that had already organized themselves into an embryonic SDS chapter. I believe the chapter was founded in February of that year. and those that were from the Akron area organized people in that city, because of course this is occurring over the summertime when they're not in school. And the students that were from Cleveland, they were doing the same thing, sometimes in conjunction with the Cleveland Peace Council, to send students from those two cities who had been Kent students to the protest. And all the leaders of the Kent State, or virtually all the leaders of the Kent State Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, participated in those protests. And certainly it contributed to them developing more of a radical edge than they already possessed.
Of course, Nixon wins that election, and when he takes office, he introduces changes that that changed the dynamic between students in general and the war itself. And I was wondering if you could describe how Nixon's election changed the protest culture at Kent State prior to 1970.
Well, this again is an interesting dynamic, and it shows how sometimes the present can help to inform the past. And we all know that the past can also inform the present. Some listeners will recall that when Barack Obama was elected, he inherited two wars. And he had been an opponent, certainly, of the Iraq War. But for a period of time, he did not withdraw American forces from either Afghanistan or Iraq. And indeed, American forces remain in Afghanistan. But generally, there weren't many protests that that occurred about his war policies from a constituency that had just elected him. And as I said earlier, I think that same dynamic was in play at Kent State between 1965 and 1968. But once Richard Nixon became the president, Kent students, many of whom, again, came from Democratic families, no longer felt inhibited by their partisan politics. And it was easier for them to shift into opposition mode, because now the war was a Republican war instead of one that had been that was being waged by a Democratic president. So I think that that was something that was very significant in terms of helping to transform the anti-war movement at Kent State. But so was the presence of a confrontational local chapter of the Kent Students for Democratic Society that, as we just discussed, was in many ways an outgrowth of the Chicago protest. And SDS, they formed an ephemeral alliance with the Black United Students at the university in 1968, and that led to a very successful protest in the fall of 68, only about a week or two after the presidential election, where students from the Black United, or undergraduates from the Black United Students as well as SDS, blocked the Oakland police from recruiting at Kent State University. The Oakland police had been responsible for a shooting in which Black Panther Party leader Eldridge Cleaver was badly wounded, and a young 17-year-old by the name of Bobby Hutton had been killed. So that showed once again that students could be successful in their protest, and like some of the protests at the dawn of the decade had also been successful, what that served to do was to further embolden the students. And in the spring of 1969, when SDS launched what they called their spring offensive, which was aimed at four university programs, but the best known of which was the Reserve Officer Training Program of the Army, of the United States Army. They quickly ran into a brick wall that the university had put up. And at a confrontation in early April of 1969, that resulted in the arrest and suspensions of six students. And within a week or two, there was a an effort to have students go in to observe some of these hearings that had been called to deal with the suspension of the students. That resulted in another 50 or 60 arrests. In the meantime, the university had banned the SDS chapter. It was one of only six chapters in the entire country to be permanently banned from a university campus. In that same month, the United States Congress announced that they were going to be investigating the Kent State University SDS, and that investigation would take place by the U.S. House of the U.S. House of Representatives Internal Security Committee, once known as the House on Un-American Activities. So, what SDS had done is they helped create a small core, and I say small, maybe 250, 300 students on the campus that were very dedicated to what they were doing, and that that's a fairly substantial group of people to be carrying on daily protest. But on the other hand, the attitude of SDS became so strident and the views of many so dogmatic that they had alienated themselves at the same time from other people who might have otherwise been sympathetic to them. But the university chose methods of, if one might say, repression aimed at the students who were in SDS that also turned off large numbers of Kent State students. And indeed, about 5,000 Kent State University students came out to protest against what the university was doing. And while that did not cause the university to back off in any way, it did help to deepen the divide between a growing progressive and anti-war community or civil libertarian community and the university administration. One might say that it caused almost a permanent estrangement between the two. And I think that that also helped to fuel the fury of the protest in 1970.
There's one of the group that you talk about that I must confess, in my previous exposure to Kent State, I had not really heard much about. And that is that by 1969, you start to see veterans returning from Vietnam who are enrolling in Kent State, and they're beginning to, some of them are beginning to participate in these protests and lend their firsthand experience with the war to the criticism of it.
Right. Well, veterans had always been part of the protest movement at Kent State from probably the mid 1950s when men were coming home from Korea. Some of them were involved in this group, the Macedonians, for instance. And there were other veterans who participated in some of the civil rights protest and certainly in the early protests against the war in Vietnam. But it wasn't until the late 1960s that veterans of Vietnam came home to protest the war in which they had just fought. And indeed, as of May 4th, 1970, there were probably about one out of every 10 male students at Kent State was either in the Army Reserves or they had served in Vietnam or maybe had seen duty in Germany or someplace like that. But they were veterans or still, in some respects, still active duty soldiers while they were going to school. So it definitely caused after the shootings. Well, let me say this too about the growth of the Vietnam veterans against the war. 1970 marked a period of time when there was explosive growth in the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, VVAW for short, not only in Ohio but throughout the country. And the first chapter of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War at Kent State was organized in the fall of 1970 after the shootings. And eventually they rose to leadership positions in the anti-war movement at Kent State, especially by 1972. So this is important because so many people even today, tend to view the student protest as having been against the soldiers. But in point and fact, veterans were becoming increasingly part of the very protest movement that some people, even to this day, misunderstand.
I wonder if you could take us now to the events of May 1970. And as you describe, it wasn't just about what happened on May 4th, that you have the revelation about, you have the announcement by the Nixon administration that they are sending troops into Cambodia, the invasion of Cambodia by the U.S. and South Vietnam, and how this begins a series of protests that extend over several days, of which May 4th is a later act of them.
Yes. First, let me say as well that, because you had asked earlier about Richard Nixon and how his policies caused, or how his election caused the change in the anti-war movement. He did campaign as a candidate that had a secret plan to end the Vietnam War. And while that was highly debatable and indeed dubious notion, given how he, in many respects, escalated the fighting in Vietnam throughout 1969, and then with the announcement that American forces were invading Cambodia in 1970, in April of 1970. At the same time, his policies did show that there was some indication that the war in Vietnam was winding down. He had already started to withdraw some American forces from Vietnam and to increase to supplant them with South Vietnamese soldiers, a process that was known as Vietnamization. In other words, replacing departing American troops with a buildup of the South Vietnamese army. He had also instituted a draft lottery in December of 1969, where every American male of military age, that is those who, between the age of 18 and 26, were assigned a lottery number by their birthday. So those who had low lottery numbers below, say, 200, still had a draft deferment as long as they remained a student. But if they were to leave school or to fail and be put out of the university for poor grades, then they would become subject to the military draft. Those who had draft numbers above 200 were largely safe from that process because they were, the military announced that they were only going to be drafting people with a number of up to about 200.
You described this one anecdote in there about how one of the people you interviewed, his roommate received a number that was like 360, and practically the next day he dropped out of the college.
Yeah, he threw himself a party that night, as I recall that part of the book, and then left school. Another friend of mine recalled that his roommates all had jobs on the railroad, and they were taking enough classes at Kent State to maintain their 2S student status, and they all left school because they felt they didn't need to go to college any longer. They already had a good-paying full-time job on the railroad,
and with a high lottery number, that was basically removed the main justification for so many of them.
Right, but conversely, if one had a lower draft number, it was all the more reason to oppose the Vietnam War because students in that situation were still threatened. Mm-hmm. This is all occurring in the spring of 1970 as well, and as were deaths in Vietnam. In my own friendship circle, I had a girlfriend at the time whose brother had been killed in Vietnam. My roommate's brother died in Vietnam on April 13th, 1970, and we were all at his funeral only days before the announcement by President Nixon that American forces were being sent into Cambodia. And indeed, my roommate's brother had been killed on the or near the Cambodian border when he was run over by an American tank by mistake. So there was a reason for the flow of the anti-Vietnam protest movement to continue, but there were also some ebbs in that movement. Some of the national organizations that had been committed to holding these nationwide protests against the Vietnam War didn't feel that there was enough support to keep their organizations going, like the Vietnam Moratorium Committee that announced that they were closing down their operations in April of that year. But the announcement by President Nixon on April 30th, 1970, that American and South Vietnamese forces were entering Cambodia changed all that. There was just an explosion of fury on many college campuses. Kent State was both the rule and the exception initially. The initial protest the following day on May 1st, 1970, could by no means be described as an explosion of fury. There were two of them. There were two protests. One dealt more with racial issues. Another dealt explicitly with the war in Vietnam. But both of them were peaceful, and they each attracted about 300 or so demonstrators. But at the one that occurred on the Commons area, which is a vast expanse, a large expanse of land right in the center of the Kent State campus, what used to be the center of the Kent State campus, the students there, before the protest broke up, many of them were milling around saying, "We'll see you downtown tonight." And someone had put up a tree that was near where this protest occurred that asked, "Why is ROTC, the Reserve Officer Training Corps of the United States Army, why is that building still standing?" Kind of a provocative question, you might say. So that evening, late in the evening, on Friday, May the 1st, a number of students went on a rampage in downtown Kent and proceeded to break out windows of a number of downtown merchants. And this was their way of releasing some of the fury that they felt about what had happened in Cambodia and the expansion of the war. That was enough to unnerved the mayor of Kent, who contacted the outgoing governor, James Rhodes, that he might need the National Guard to be sent to Kent. And the National Guard had already been mobilized at that point in Ohio because of a month-long Wildcat Teamster strike, where some of the Teamsters had been using their guns to force non-compliant drivers off the road. And there were thousands of National Guardsmen that were already on duty. So when the protest reoccurred on Saturday evening, Governor Rhodes sent the National Guard into Kent. And by the time that they arrived, the ROTC building that I mentioned earlier had already been set aflame by dozens of student militants that were supported by at least several thousand anti-war protesters that had marched around the campus. And that's when the first confrontation between the Ohio National Guard and the anti-war students occurred. The following night, Sunday evening, and for these events, I was not an eyewitness to them. But the confrontation, if anything, became uglier because students were tear-gassed when they tried to block an intersection in downtown Kent. The National Guard went at them with bayonets, and four or five students, and as well as a non-student passing motorist, an older man actually, were cut or stabbed by National Guard bayonets. Unfortunately, none of these wounds were lethal, but it was an even more dangerous reminder of just how ugly and dangerous the confrontation was getting. So by Monday, May the 4th, we're now into the fourth day of protest. Students who on May 1st had held this initial protest on the Commons area were told to reassemble on May 4th to continue their protest against the Cambodian invasion, not knowing, of course, on May 1st that any of these later protests were going to occur or that the National Guard would be sent onto their campus. So by noontime on May the 4th, the character of the protest had really changed. While Cambodia had receded, the issue of Cambodia had receded some into the background, and now it was the presence in the town of Kent and on the campus of Kent State of over 1,200 guardsmen that was the real issue. And Kent was often referred to as a suitcase college, and where many of the students go home to their neighboring communities over the weekend. So they certainly would have been mindful and aware of the, if they had been away from campus while this was going on, that these things were taking place. Of course, it was a huge story in Northeast Ohio. But hearing about them and seeing it on television is one thing. Arriving back in town and finding National Guardsmen in front of your dorms and armored personnel carriers being stationed at several of the intersections in town was a very jarring experience. And for the white students, something they had never seen before. The African-American students were more familiar with this because they had already experienced National Guard occupation of their communities in the late 1960s in Akron and in Cleveland. But for white students, it was something that most of them had never seen before. So the stage was really set for a confrontation on Monday, May 4th, 1970.
You describe an element that of which they would have been totally unaware, which is the degree to which several members of the Guard were making a point of arming themselves with guns, not just the M1 rifles that the soldiers had, or in some cases M14s, but you describe how one officer had a .22 pistol because he felt that his baton would be insufficient. That there was a real sense among many people within the Guard that there was a desire for payback after having experienced 2 days of insults and having had rocks thrown at them, that there was a hunger for some sort of decisive confrontation.
Yes, the group that was stoned on Saturday night when they first drove into town was the 107th Armored Cavalry. And that unit contained the largest, there were three members of three companies that were involved in the fatal shootings, but it was that same unit that it was determined had the largest number of enlisted men who had opened fire on the students.
And yet the students themselves would not have known that there would be an escalation beyond what they already experienced. As bad as the bayoneting, the tear gassing was, there had yet to be any sort of discharge of firearms on the part of the Guard.
Right, but it was an ugly environment. To give like one example, the student who's on the cover of the book, Alan Canfora, the day before he had been driving around Kent with a Vietnam veteran friend of his, and a guardsman had put a bayonet on the end of his rifle into the open car window, as a measure of intimidation. And then on May 4th, 1970, he was carrying two protest flags from his off-campus apartment up to the rally, and a guardsman accosted him en route to the rally, and he said something to the effect, what you got there, boy? And Canfora, who's ordinarily kind of a combative person, but he didn't want to, renew the tension, initially responded by simply saying, oh, I've just got just a couple of protest flags. And then the guardsman said, well, we're going to make you eat those flags today. And then at that, Canfora got his dander up, and he said something, to the effect, well, if you get too close, I'm going to shove them down your throat. So that kind of, in microcosm, that showed the, or revealed the kind of tension that existed between the students and the National Guard. In terms of their armament, they did possess about four or five kinds of military weaponry, the most dangerous of which, of course, was the M1 that can kill at distances of up to a mile, steel-jacketed ammunition. It's powerful enough, as I understand it, to actually go through an engine block. And there's a steel sculpture on the university campus that was actually right between the guardsmen and the students that they fired upon. And that took an M1 bullet went through that, and it just blew right through the statue. So that was the most lethal weapon that was used. But they also had 45s, two types of shotguns. One officer brought an AR-15 to the rally, and there were several private handguns. They were not supposed to carry those onto the campus or use them in the course of their duty, but some of these guardsmen were also policemen, so they were accustomed to carrying, you know, private weapons. And indeed, one of them was accustomed to carrying what they call a throwdown. So in the event that a policeman would shoot an unarmed person, but later wanted to make the argument that that person was armed, and that all they would need to do is take the weapon that they had and put that down next to the body, and then that's where the justification would come from. And indeed, one of the guard commanders did that very thing on the body of Jeff Miller, who is in the best-known photograph that was taken of Kent State, in fact, won the Pulitzer Prize, where the young woman is kneeling over the body of the slain student. He, a National Guard captain, said that he found a handgun on Jeff Miller's body, which wasn't true, and he later had to admit under oath that it was not.
So describe the events of May 4th, how the shooting took place, what were the circumstances, and what was the what happened in the aftermath?
Well, the initial protest occurred again in this area known as the Commons, and on one edge of the Commons had stood the ROTC building that by then was just in ruins. It was a total loss. It was a wooden structure, an old military-style barracks that had been used to house soldiers during World War II. It had been disassembled and then reassembled on Kent State University campus sometime in the 1950s, and that was the headquarters of ROTC. It probably would have been torn down eventually anyway, but the contents of the building were probably worth $50,000, not an inconsiderable sum of money, and that had been destroyed in the fire on May the 2nd. So the guard unit, about approximately 105 guardsmen, were standing on a picket line or a skirmish line in front of that building. On the other side of this expanse of open land known as the Commons, stood gathered between 500 and 1,000 protesters, of which maybe 300 of which were truly active and boisterous, the rest of whom were standing nearby in kind of a sympathetic pose. And then there were another probably 2,000 to 3,000 students that were onlookers at various other places in the vicinity. And the National Guard had somewhat misunderstood what the governor had maintained. And by the way, he held a very bellicose news conference on May the 3rd, where he said that the students at Kent State were the worst type of people. This is an exact quote, were the worst type of people that we harbor in America, worse than the brown shirts and the communist element and the night riders. And he also indicated that if it took shooting to put a stop to it, that that wasn't off the table. And in fact, the word that he used about the student protest at Kent State was that he was going to eradicate it, quote unquote. So this, of course, contributes to this charged environment. And around noontime, the National Guard dispatched a jeep that had a campus policeman in it and several guardsmen, and they drove out a short distance to where the students were assembled, and the campus policeman, whose name was Harold Rice, was using a bullhorn to amplify his voice, and he was pleading with the students to leave. He was saying, "All of you innocent people, go to your homes, leave this area immediately. This is an illegal assembly." And I think that he meant well. I came to know Harold Rice in the years afterwards, and he was a good man. But at that moment, all it did was to further inflame the students, and it was very apparent that the students were not going to leave. The attitude was that this was their campus. If anyone ought to leave, it's the National Guard and not the students. And they felt that they, because at that point it was a peaceful assembly, that they that there was no reason why they should adhere to this order to depart from this area of the campus. So the Jeep then, it was a rock that was thrown at the Jeep. I think it bounced off the tire. It didn't hit anyone. But that was a further indication that the students were not going to heed this order that was being given to them by this campus policeman with the authority of the Ohio National Guard backing him up. So the Jeep drove back to the National Guard lines, and the guardsmen were ordered to lock and load by their general, whose name was Robert Canterbury, I believe was the first name. Canterbury, definitely the last name. And then he ordered the grenadiers in among the guardsmen to load their tear gas. There was a faculty member who approached the general, and he pleaded with him not to advance on the students. And the general told the professor that these students are going to have to find out what law and order is all about. And within a very short period of time, seconds or minutes later, the tear gas was fired into the students, which dispersed them in all different directions, the majority of which retreated up a hill that was right behind one side of this expansive land landscape known as the Commons, and they had to retreat up a very steep hill past an architectural building known as Taylor Hall, and then down the more gradual decline on the other side. And what the National Guard were attempting to do was to go after the students and then block off their ability to regather on the Commons. So, in effect, disperse the protest and then prevent the students from recongregating on the on Commons where the protest had originated. And had they remained at the very top of this hill that I just mentioned, they would have succeeded in doing so. And the guard units had to break into two groups because of this large building that dominates the hillside, this Taylor Hall architecture building. And one group of guardsmen stayed on the left side of it, and the other group was supposed to stay on the right side of it. But for reasons that were never fully explained, the general, Robert Canterbury, he took his men down the hillside after the students. And when he got down to the bottom of this hill on a practice football field, he found that this group of 75 guardsmen were confronting a chain-link fence on one side with an asymmetrical crowd of students on the other three sides. So they had placed themselves tactically in a poor situation. And there was a major by the name of Harry Jones, who had been with this other group that had stayed on the hillside where they were supposed to. He walked right through all these student protesters unharmed down to where this group of 75 guardsmen being led by a general and a lieutenant colonel were congregated, and in effect said to them, this is not an exact quote, but, "What are you doing down here? You've placed yourselves in a bad situation. You need to go back up to the top of the hill where you were supposed to be." So you had the unusual situation of a major bringing tactical clarity to several commanding officers. But what some people also believe happened while this discussion was taking place is you have students that are continuing to throw rocks at the guardsmen throwing rocks, some guardsmen throwing rocks back at the students, and then some guardsmen for the first time that day taking a kneeling position and aiming their rifles at least one of the students, this young man by the name of Alan Canfora, whose picture is on the cover of the book. And indeed, it's this picture that I'm describing. And that was the first time, the second time that day that they had actually leveled their rifles in a very menacing pose. They had done so once earlier on the other side of the architecture building, Taylor Hall, when they were first dispersing the protests. So some people believe that the guardsmen, that some of the guardsmen at that point determined that if they felt that their lives were in any way in danger when they reached the top of the hill, that they were going to let loose on the students. So they formed themselves into a V formation with some guardsmen watching the rear and conducted this retrograde movement from the practice football field back up towards the top of the hill that they had just come over. And the students thought that they were going to retreat back down to the commons. So the students were yelling and screaming at them. It was incredibly loud. It was very hard to hear anything. And there was no tear gas that was being fired at this point, although the guardsmen did retain a few tear gas rounds. And there was some rock throwing that was still going on. And when the guardsmen reached the very apex of this hill, an area that is marked by an architectural item that was put up by some architectural students that is called, it's kind of misnamed as a pagoda. It's really almost like an umbrella shaped structure. They suddenly executed a 130 degree turn. And you can, on the audio tape of the shootings, you can hear unmistakably two loud shots, and they came from M1 rifles. And the M1 rifle is a very, very loud weapon. It's unmistakable. And as soon as the students heard that, they proceeded to start running, and then it was followed by another 12-second fuselage of firing that brought down 13 students in 13 seconds.
So you have
the closest student was about 60 feet away, and the furthest student was over 400 feet away.
So you have the situation where you have students on the ground bleeding, some of them dying, not all of whom were involved in the protest, as you described. Some of them were simply walking across campus when they were shot. And you have a situation of great chaos where afterward, you know, you have people that are being rushed to the hospital. You also describe how the guard then withdraws and they begin to assess what had just happened on their side.
Right. One of the unit of guardsmen, it was Company C of the 145th Infantry, that was captained and commanded by a man by the name of James Ronald Snyder. And he was a Portage County detective. He took some of his men down into the parking lot where they saw at least two of the students that had been slain, including this student by the name of Jeff Miller, whose slain body is pictured in the famous photograph that was taken that day. And he said that he found a gun on Miller's body. He later had to recant that. But by that point, the fury of the students was almost like unrestrained, and they were screaming at the guardsmen, "You effing murderers, and, you know, get the hell out of here." And they did discharge another tear gas canister down there. I think a student got it wound up with a cut lip from it somehow, and they bid a hasty retreat. So the guardsmen had the other unit of guardsmen that had done the firing, they continued their retrograde movement over the hill, back down the steep side of it onto the commons. And then the students, incredibly enough, those who had not been killed or injured or who were busy aiding the students who had been. They also followed the guardsmen and went back down onto the commons and sat there in a compact mass and refused to leave. And this is where as horrific as the events already were, this could have caused Kent State to go from about a dozen casualties into scores of casualties. It could have been on the scale of, say, the Sharpeville massacre in South Africa in 1960, where, you know, several score people were killed because the students refused to leave the spot where they had congregated. And there were several hundred of them that sat down. And the guardsmen surrounded the students, and they said that they had 5 minutes, and then they were going to open fire into this compact mass. And a geology professor who was well known and highly regarded by the students. He looked like a former Army or Marine Corps officer or soldier. And I believe he did serve in the military. He had a crew cut and kind of sharp chiseled features. He broke down. He was pleading with the students. He says, if you've never listened to anybody before in your lives, you've got to leave. I don't want you to die in this place. And the kind of authority that he carried with the students and the impassioned tone that he took with them was enough to finally get the students to get up and to begin dispersing to avert a wider slaughter, of which there almost certainly would have been. Because the guard gave every indication, and they've never given any indications since, that they wouldn't have opened fire a second time. In the meantime, on the other side of the commons, the other side of this hillside where the shootings occurred, you've got complete chaos. Students being carried by fellow students into dormitories. There's a famous picture on the cover of Life magazine of a student by the name of Joe Cullum taking, clothing articles off and stuffing them into the chest cavity of another student by the name of John Cleary, who'd to try to stem the blood loss. Students being loaded into ambulances. Some of them were able to hail rides from, private vehicles and be transported that way to the hospital. But it was a very, very chaotic and horrific scene. And it was made more so because while it was a confrontation, in some ways you had a group of unarmed student combatants facing armed National Guard combatants, it's important to realize that while the Guard were heavily outnumbered, there were about 100 guardsmen that had dispersed at least 1,000 students, that while they were heavily outnumbered, that the students were entirely outgunned.
So what happened in the aftermath of that day? How did the government officials respond? What happened to the students who survived? What happened to the guard members?
Well, the school was closed that day, and it remained closed until the graduation ceremonies in June of 1970. And really didn't they did have summer classes, they weren't that well attended, so you really didn't have a true reopening of the school until late September of 1970, which denied Kent State students the opportunity to have any kind of a memorial service on their campus. I mean, memorial services occurred on campuses throughout the rest of the United States, but not at Kent State. Kent State, along with Cambodia, and then later the shootings at Jackson State College in Jackson, Mississippi, all of that produced a student strike across the United States that was the largest in American history. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 million students participated in it, and it really did shake the very foundations of higher education in the United States. It also produced an emergency protest in Washington in a six-day period of time. Some of the remaining national anti-war organizations were able to organize a huge protest in Washington that drew 100,000 people on, a few short days' notice. So the country was really in turmoil. There were members of the Nixon administration that were resigning, angry words being exchanged at every level of American society. And in terms of the National Guard, they were made to order because they had discharged their weapons. They had to file after-action reports that day. And within a few days, there were dozens of FBI agents in town investigating both the burning of the ROTC building and the discharge of fatal shots by the Ohio National Guard. There was an additional investigation by the Ohio Highway Patrol in June of 1970. And the uproar was such in the United States that President Nixon felt it necessary to convene a presidential panel to look into the causes of student unrest. And that was chaired by the governor or former governor of Pennsylvania by the name of William Scranton. He was a moderate to liberal Republican. And the commission took his name. It became known as the Scranton Commission. And that commission found, I don't recall the exact quote, but it said something to the effect that discharge of shots by the Ohio National Guard was unexcusable and unnecessary.
As you described, though, even after Kent State faded from the scene, you still have a lot of the people involved dealing with the aftermath of it. Some of them were arrested and tried. Members were sued in civil court, and how that took years to resolve itself.
Yes, the legal aftermath of Kent State did not occur until, or did not end until January of 1979, when there was an out of court settlement for a civil damages suit that those who had been those who had been wounded at Kent State and the families of those four students that that were slain there had initiated against the Ohio National Guard, the then governor of the state, and in fact, in the 1970s, he was reelected, James Rhodes. He was the longest-serving governor in Ohio history, and also the president of the university, Robert I. White, who I talked about earlier. One thing I would like to add here is that it remains the widespread belief of many, including a number of historians, that dissent, that 1960s dissent died in a small Ohio town on May 4th, 1970. And my book is a book that, while it places Kent State in both the local, state, national, and indeed international context, at the same time, it focuses the story rather tightly on Kent State. So I don't try to make grand claims about what was going on throughout the country at large after the spring and summer of 1970. But at Kent State, what the fatal shootings produced was two or three more years of widespread activism, and that activism at Kent State lasted as long as did the Vietnam War.
There are pictures in your book that are showing how the protests continued into 1971, 72. The students remained very engaged. So if it died somewhere else, it certainly thrived in Kent State.
Right. And then, of course, they erupted again in the late 1970s when the university decided that they would build a gymnasium annex on a part of the campus where the National Guard had maneuvered on May 4th, 1970. And the students and ex-students and non-students conducted a six-month campaign to prevent that caused the largest mass arrest in the history of Kent State University. So these protests were going on as late as October of 1977.
Well, Tim, before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, I actually returned to what had been originally a concentration in the American Civil War. That course that I teach is a part-time professor at the local community college, and I do articles for popular format Civil War magazines and also scholarly journals such as the Register, which is the journal of the Kentucky Historical Society on the American Civil War.
Okay. Tom, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us today. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Well, I appreciate very much this opportunity, Mark, and thank you for your very informed questions.